Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome and see if he wants to join the Pistons, John Rogers.
Thank you very much, Mayor Archer, for a very warm and kind introduction. Mayor Archer has been a longtime hero of mine, someone I've always looked up to and admired and respected. So it's been great to get to know you all these years, over all these years at our Black Corporate Directors Conference, and your leadership there has been absolutely terrific. So I'd like to thank you for that. It's also the first time I've been ever introduced as a part of the invocation. So I think in my career, so I also appreciate those comments. It's very, very warm of you. I can't help but mention a little bit about the basketball. I wouldn't normally do this, but thank you for the opening. You know, I used to go to Michael Jordan's fantasy camp, and the quick story was every year he would challenge campers to a quick game of three, and the day that I beat him, I think he had played 20 campers before he got to me. He was very tired. I think he was overconfident because no one had ever won in the first 7 years of the fantasy camp. But the cool thing is if you Google John Rogers and Michael Jordan, you can see the 4-minute video and you can hear him say, oh no, when the last shot goes in. And so. But it is a pleasure to be here. Detroit area has been very, very good to us at Ariel. We have some very important clients here, Chrysler, Dow, General Motors, and the AAA of Michigan, you know, really some of our most substantial and important relationships, so we're really greatly appreciative. But you know, Michigan and Detroit, it's really been a great, great area for strong African-American-owned businesses. And I'll talk a little bit more about African-American businesses that, because that's what I've lived my life, you know, 35 years being an entrepreneur. My parents were entrepreneurs, and so I know that experience. But I know the challenges that we face in the African-American community are also faced by Latino leaders and women leaders and other diverse communities. And so I just wanted to get that out front. But here in the Detroit area, you guys probably, I'm sure you all know this, but this last year, 2017, Black Enterprise list of the top 100 black companies in the country, Detroit had 15 firms, which is by far the most of any other city in the BE 100. More than twice as much as my hometown, Chicago, and New York. It's pretty incredible. 40 years ago, my hometown led the list with iconic businesses like Johnson Products with AfroSheen and UltraSheen, Johnson Publishing, everybody knows that great business with Ebony and Jet Magazine, and we even had Al Johnson Cadillac. You know, throughout the country, in the black community, we were known as Johnson City, because of all these iconic businesses that were doing so well. But unfortunately, those businesses are no longer a part of the BE 100, and as things have gone on, and again, we haven't been doing as well in Chicago as we would have hoped to. But today, again, that Detroit is the home of large, successful businesses of scale, a true role model for the rest of the nation. I recently read the Crane's Detroit story that talked about Vinnie Johnson and his great success at the Piston Group. And now that he's made the acquisition of Irwin Automotive Products, he has 8,300 employees, 15 plants, and he's forecasted over $2.8 billion in revenue for 2018, a really substantial, meaningful business of scale. And we all know how important that is to our urban communities when you can have these types of businesses. We know that minority-owned companies can provide vitally needed jobs, role models, wealth, and philanthropy. Harvard Business School professor Stephen Rogers has done an enormous amount of research in this area. He finds that white-owned companies located in urban communities have 32% minority employment, while black-owned companies located in similar communities have 85% minority employees. So it's so important to have African-American businesses in our urban communities. And of course, we all know there's no doubt that when we have strong minority businesses, great things happen. Innovation is enhanced, complex problems are more effectively resolved. And as Reverend Jackson always says, when you think about it, not only in business or in academia, but when you think about sports, there's no doubt, for example, in baseball, that it became a much better sport once Jackie Robinson started to play, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, and our own Ernie Banks. Once they were in the big leagues, it became a greater, better sport. And of course, they weren't allowed to participate for generations. I really believe that this type of leadership that I've described here in Detroit is really critical in closing the wealth and opportunity gap in the country's minority communities and in our states and throughout our country. We all know the data. I know you've seen the data. I was watching CBS morning, Sunday morning show yesterday morning, and Ta-Nehisi Coates talked about the fact on television yesterday that the average black family has a nickel for every dollar that a white family has, when it comes to wealth. That's pretty incredible when you think about that. And then recently, the St. Louis Fed's Ray Bashar came up with data that showed that between 1992 and 2013, things have just gotten steadily worse when it comes to wealth creation. He has data that shows during that 21-year period, college-educated blacks saw their wealth decline 55%, while college-educated whites saw their wealth increase 86% during that same period. So down 55% for black families, up 86% for whites. Pretty incredible in a 20-year period to see that type of decline. So what I'd like to do today is to focus my remarks around the thought that this wealth gap has grown and grown and grown because we haven't been participating in the parts of the economy where the wealth and the jobs and the philanthropy are being created today. And so what I'd like to do is sort of discuss that problem in some detail and then talk about some solutions and some things we've been doing in Chicago and some things that we've been doing at Ariel that we think can maybe be helpful in helping this wealth gap to be closed. Now, one of the challenges that we face when we talk about that BE list that I talked about earlier, the BE list is really primarily focused on manufacturing companies that have really benefited from well-meaning, successful supplier diversity programs. And we think that's great. I know that the National Supplier Development Council had a great conference here in Detroit recently. It was sold out. And what they do is so important. And it's so important for us to be involved in all the businesses, to be involved with heavy manufacturing, to be involved in supply chain. Those things are critical. But the problem today is often supply chain companies have the lowest margins and the most cyclicality. And in today's economy, the wealth and jobs are being created in other areas. So an example that we've been talking about in Chicago and at Ariel is that recently Forbes magazine came up with their 100th anniversary issue. And they show that in 1917, the companies kind of looked like the BE 100 list. The America's largest companies were primarily industrial and mining companies. Companies like U.S. Steel, Bethlehem Steel, International Harvester, Anaconda Copper. But if you look ahead 100 years to 2017, America's largest companies are in technology and in financial services and professional services, broadly speaking. You think about companies like Apple, Google, Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, et cetera. Those are our largest companies that really employ the most people and generate the most wealth. At Ariel, those are the kind of companies, when you think about those businesses, today's businesses are the companies that have the highest profit margins, they have low capital needs, they generate a lot of cash, they have great, great brands, tremendous cash flow again, and the kind of companies that you feel like you could own for the next 10 years, and they'll just get better and better and better, stronger and stronger and stronger. Those are the kind of companies that we look for at Ariel. We want to kind of find those wonderful Warren Buffett types of businesses that you can really truly own for the long run. So it wouldn't be a surprise that you know that our logo at Ariel is a turtle to remind people that long-term investing wins and that slow and steady wins the race. That's really an important part of what we talk about. Now, our turtle is kind of innocent and small. It's not like the Dreyfus Lion or the Merrill Lynch Bull or the T. Rowe Price Ram. But we believe in it deeply, and we think that it's the way that we can be successful as investors, but it also is a reminder of the kind of businesses that can be successful in today's economy. When I look at our top holdings that we have at Ariel Investments and Ariel Fund, which is our flagship fund that's 31 years old this month, it's one of the longest serving funds with the same portfolio manager in charge. Our top three companies, you wouldn't be surprised, fit into the themes that I've been talking about today. Our top two companies are in financial services. We own KKR, you know, a fund that was founded by Henry Kravitz and his cousin Roberts. And they're one of the leading global companies when it comes to private equity in the world. Very, very profitable. They have over 1 million employees. When you look at all the companies they control and they touch, they are extraordinarily involved in our communities around the world. Very, very profitable business. The second largest holding is Lazard, a global investment banking firm, which has enormous exposure to not only investment banking, but also a large money management and mutual fund company focused on emerging markets and international investing, a fast-growing part of the financial services world. And our third largest company is Zebra Technologies, which is a local company in the Chicago area known for and is focused on thermal barcode printers and scanners. They have big customers. One of their biggest customers is not only the giant retailers, but is now Amazon, that needs that scanning technology to be able to keep track of their exploding inventories throughout the world and throughout the nation. So we think that's so critically important for us to kind of focus, and those are the kind of businesses we think will be the most successful businesses going forward. Now, when I looked at individuals and where the wealth's being created, you know, we looked at the annual Forbes 400 list of the wealthiest and most influential people in America. And of course, they're naturally concentrated in these same sectors. That's where all the wealth's being created. So the example I give, of course, in technology, we all know that Bill Gates is extraordinarily rich. At Microsoft, his Microsoft stock and all of his other investments, he's worth over $86 billion, the richest person in the world. We all know how social media is exploding. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg is worth over $70 billion. And on Wall Street, where so much wealth is being created and gets into a lot of the political discussions now about is that appropriate or not appropriate, but Blackstone's Steven Schwarzman is worth over $12 billion. And it's interesting, he makes $600 million a year in a normal year, and he has 600,000 employees, again, through all those private equity companies that he controls. Think about the power and influence that comes from a successful private equity person in this world. You know, in the old days, it was the Rockefellers and the giant families like that that made all the wealth, the Mellons, et cetera. Now it's these guys. And then finally, back in Chicago, the wealthiest person is not an industrialist, it's not a Crown or a Pritzker, but instead, it's Citadel's Ken Griffin, who is worth over $8 billion. He often makes over $1 billion a year as a top hedge fund manager in the United States. He's just around 50 years old. I mean, he's already the wealthiest person in Chicago. And then just last week, you might have seen that he announced that he was giving a very generous $125 million gift to the University of Chicago to have the economics department named after him. So again, it shows the kind of influence these kind of people have in today's society. So what I'm most troubled about and worried about is that we as minority entrepreneurs are not well positioned to benefit from the parts of these tomorrow's companies that are doing so well. You know, too often I think we're encouraged and supported only if we participate in construction, commodity, and supply chain opportunities. And again, that's why I give Detroit so much credit, because your auto leadership and so many of your other heavy manufacturers have been willing to work with minority businesses throughout the spend. But that is the exception in the country. Most other giant companies only, again, will work in the commodity space and the supplier space and not include people in the professional services space. So we did some research on that, and I talked to a lot of leaders here in the Detroit area, and I looked at the Detroit area Crain's business publication. I looked at the Chicago business publication. And one of the things that you still find, because we don't have enough anchor institutions working with us across the board, is that when you look at professional services, for example, and they list the top 25 accounting firms, law firms, insurance firms, private equity firms, and banks, there are typically zero African-American companies that make the top 25 in all those professional services economies. And you know the heads of those firms are all the people that are going to be the members of all the top leadership groups throughout the local communities. And then similarly, as I looked at those Crain's list and looked at it through technology, You look at the top IT companies, the top venture capital companies, the top biotech companies. Again, very little exposure to minority or African-American-owned companies. And again, the wealth, so much wealth being created in these areas, so much wealth being created in venture capital, et cetera. So in my hometown, not only do we have that same problem of not enough minority-owned businesses, we also have a scarcity of successful minority-owned companies. We have a scarcity of minority-owned up-and-coming business leaders in the majority companies in all of these areas. Again, it's the most lucrative parts of our economy. So for example, in Chicago, our largest investment bank has 160 partners, one African-American. That's the same number they had 20 years ago. It hasn't changed. When we look at the private equity, venture capital, and hedge fund firms again, all the firms of scale, almost zero African-American partners, and most of them never even had an African-American professional in those fields in Chicago. And it's marginally better at our largest law firms, accounting firms, consulting firms. Very, very few partners. So I tell people all the time, it's kind of unfortunate, but the average black male Chicago high school student has a much better chance of becoming a professional athlete than becoming a partner in all these professions put together. It's not even close. And most people just don't think about it that way, but it clearly is the fact. So what are the solutions? So one of the things we've been working on in Chicago is a program called CASE, Chicago Anchors for a Strong Economy. And it reaches out beyond the traditional government programs, encourages all of our hospitals, museums, sports teams, foundations, professional services companies to work with local and minority-owned businesses across the board. And I'd have to say the University of Chicago has been the shining role model of how to do this well. From a standing start 10 years ago, they've gone from zero to now working with over 60 professional services companies at the University of Chicago and the University of Chicago Hospital. You can talk, for example, the head of the local radio station who will tell you, the local black radio station, who will tell you she made payroll simply one week or whenever the payroll was, because the University of Chicago Hospital was advertising on her local radio station and how important that is. But they're also working with black advertising agencies, advertising in black publications, using African-American law firms, accounting firms, architecture firms. They have 15 minority firms managing part of the endowment at the University of Chicago. So I give the University of Chicago real credit for taking this extraordinarily seriously. And what they do, instead of calling their program supplier diversity, they call it business diversity, which we think is a really great idea because it gives us a picture they want to work with people of color in all the fields and all the things that they do. So what are we doing about it at Ariel? We have this saying at Ariel that we just don't like to admire the problem, but try to roll up our sleeves and make a difference. I talked about getting to meet Mayor Archer at the Black Corporate Directors Conference, and it's really been a real success over the last 16 years or so. We partnered with Russell Reynolds and a gentleman named Charles Tribbett there, who's the senior partner. And the idea was that we would try to bring together these diverse directors and learn from each other how to be leaders in the boardroom, and again, how to lead around the civil rights agenda once you get into the boardroom. And the first year, we had about 30 directors at the Gleacher Center in Chicago. And this last year, we had over 200 directors and over 350 guests at the Hotel The Montage in Laguna Beach. Shows you what happens when you move from downtown Chicago to Laguna Beach. You get a lot greater attendance. But it's been a really, really successful, really, really successful story. And it's something that we've been really proud of. Now, Melody Hobson, our president, who's been with us 27 years, uses her relationships to really get some of the best speakers you can imagine. This last year, you know, again, we had Howard Schultz. We had Shonda Rhimes. We had Kerry Washington, for those of you that like Scandal. You know, it was, we had Rodriguez, who had played for the New York Yankees, was there speaking. We just had an extraordinary group of diverse speakers. Again, people from all different walks of life. But the highlight of the conference is every year we try to have what we call the conscience of the conference, someone to remind us of the responsibility to fight for civil rights in the boardroom. So over the years, we've had Harry Belafonte, we've had Bruce Gordon from the NAACP, had Valerie Jarrett and Eric Holder from the Obama administration, and of course, legendary leaders like John Lewis, Andy Young, and Reverend Jackson there to really try and remind us that we have to fight the good fight and we have a responsibility to speak up often. And I often use, you know, the legendary leader from who served on the General Motors board for a number of years, Leon Sullivan. Because when he was on the General Motors board, he had the Sullivan principles to help focus that institution on how to deal with the South African issue at that time. And that's the kind of thing that we have to do as minority and African-American and Latino directors, is to be able to create and be able to have that same type of legacy that we leave when we leave that board. And one of the things we often talk about at the board meetings at our conference is we want to make sure that we live up to the three P's. Our three P's are not as famous as the Sullivan principles, but they're all about how we can make sure that we all agree to ask questions about how the money's being spent at our corporations, purchasing, to hold people accountable on the people of their leadership team and the leadership team of the professional services firms that work with those institutions. That's going to be the people side. And then finally, we have a philanthropy side. And we want to make sure that these companies are spending money with minority-focused institutions, the Urban Leagues, the NAACPs, institutions like that, and so the dollars aren't only going to universities or hospitals. So we're really working hard on trying to make sure that those three P's are lived up to. And we hope that everyone can keep track of all the spending at their companies by category, not just one big gross number, but how much are the legal fees, how much are the advertising fees, how much are the investment fees, as well as the construction fees and the contracting fees. We want to be able to keep track of everything. Second thing that we've been able to do at Ariel that we think makes a difference is that 22 years ago, we started a small public school. It's called the Ariel Community Academy. And it was founded by Arnie Duncan and his sister while they were working at Ariel. You know, we never dreamed one day that Arnie would be in the cabinet. But Arnie's done an extraordinary job, you know, as a leader. But the quick headlines there is the school is 500 students, K through 8. We teach the kids about the stock market and investing. We give them real money to invest, starting in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And then we try to make sure they get exposed to as much as possible. They work with our analysts on how to pick stocks. We bring in speakers from George Lucas to Magic Johnson to Joe Mansueto, the founder of Morningstar, to expose the kids to as much as possible. We hope that every year that I can take them to the McDonald's annual meeting where they can learn what it's like to be in an annual meeting, get a chance to meet with the CEO and the chairman of the board. And we're hoping at the end of the day that these young students will not only be building wealth for themselves individually and being financially secure for their college and their first home and whatever they're going to be doing financially and getting ready for retirement, but we hope these young people start to think about financial services careers, start to think about entrepreneurship, and those are the types of benefits we think that a strong financial literacy program can mean in local communities. And finally, when the kids graduate from eighth grade, they get to really have part of the profits for themselves. And it's kind of a neat thing to see the kids when they realize they've actually made money through their investment choices. And if they put the money into a 529 program, we match it with $500. So the kids have a chance to learn about matching as they get prepared for that first 401k plan. And then the final program that we've created that's come up recently is at the University of Chicago, we created a paid internship program for U of C students to work in endowment offices throughout the United States. This first year we had 11 students and they worked everywhere from the Kresge Foundation in this area to the Knight Foundation in Miami to the MacArthur and Joyce Foundations in Chicago. And it's been a great opportunity. If you think about it, if you work in an investment office of an endowment, there's no better place to learn about financial services careers as all the people who come in to sell services to those institutions are you're going to have a chance to be exposed to. So we're really thrilled about that program and think it's going to make a difference. So, you know, in closing, you know, I believe that all of us in the room here can make a difference if we ask these questions and push for fairness and inclusion in all the leadership roles that we have. And I tell people, I didn't think of this myself. I learned about thinking about asking these questions around spending with minority-owned companies and making sure majority companies had diverse partners and executives. I learned it from political leaders of the past. You know, pioneers like Maynard Jackson in Atlanta, Mayor Archer here, of course, Detroit, Carol Washington in my hometown in Chicago. They fought for these issues. They were consistent. They were on message. And I think all of us as leaders can do exactly the same thing. So at the end of the day, I always love my favorite King, my favorite quote from Dr. King, I think, is appropriate for this. He wrote in 1967 that I cannot see how the Negro will be totally liberated from the crushing weight of poor education, squalid housing, and economic strangulation until he is integrated with power into every level of American life. So that simply is our goal. We want to be integrated with power into every level of American life. Thank you.
John, could you amplify a little bit more regarding the Aereo Community Academy, specifically its focus on financial literacy, and why you think those eighth grade students are outperforming other students in the nation? You talked about real money. What do you mean by giving them real money to work with?
Well, thank you. One of the things we are learning, the students are doing very, very well from a academic standpoint. Our school has got great rankings within the Chicagoland community. And we think by learning about the stock market and having a robust financial literacy curriculum, it's helping with their math skills. When you think about it, you learn about PE ratios and you start to think about investing, a lot of it is math oriented. So we think that's been, you know, terrific. The way the program works in terms of getting them the real money is that every first grade class, again, gets a $20,000 class gift. And they watch us manage it over the first 6 years. And we send them age-appropriate statements showing how the money is growing. And then, again, they start to make the real choices when they get to sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. As you can imagine, by working with our analysts, they really do learn about how to think about picking individual stocks and doing the research. And we try to get down to the school on a regular basis. We like to have them come down to our offices on a regular basis. One of the things that's been one of the achievements from the program is that we have had a number of the students who graduated from the Aereo Community Academy go to the University of Chicago Laboratory School, which is in the community there, and on our family scholarship. And then several of the kids then have gone on to work as summer interns at Aereo. And now we have two full-time graduates from the Aereo Community Academy that work full-time at Aereo Investments. So it's nice to see that these young people are growing and have made these life choices to be in the most lucrative parts of our economy. And there's been a lot of great stories. We've also built an alumni network to stay in touch with the young people and to be able to monitor and measure their success as they come into adulthood. So it's been a good, great. So final thing I would say, they also have an impact on their parents and their extended families, helping people think about investing in the stock market for the first time. So the school has been really great. And President Obama, because the school is just four blocks away from where he lived in Chicago, he asked me to chair his national committee on financial literacy. And our recommendation to the president at the end of the second term was that we need to find ways to get other financial services companies to partner with urban public schools around financial services curriculum and being involved in the schools on a regular basis. Because we know STEM is important, but we think financial security is also very, very important.
You were fortunate to have a father who gave you stocks as opposed to toys for birthday and Christmas. But when you started Aereo Investment, was that something that was just explosive and easy to do? Were you encouraged to get into what you ultimately have achieved?
Well, thank you. I was very fortunate to have a pioneering father. And I'll often tell people, when I was born, he was 39 years old, and he had been a Tuskegee Airman in World War II, flew over 100 missions, but he had had a lot of time to plan my life before I was actually born. So he had everything was set up, you know. At age 16, I had to have a summer job, and I became a vendor at Wrigley Field in Sox Park, selling everything from popcorn to peanuts to beer and Cokes. We got a savings account at the local African-American run savings and loan. I got a checking account at Independence Bank, the largest black bank in the country. So he wanted me exposed to everything, and it had a really, you know, sort of big impact on me. But it gave me the confidence, to your question, Mayor Archer, to make my own investment choices when I was in college, make my own investment choices those first couple years out of college. And I always tell people, hopefully I made all the worst mistakes, you know, getting going, you know, like trying to get rich in the options market quickly, buying penny stocks and hoping to get rich quickly. Losing my own money at that early age was probably a good lesson to help prepare me to start Ariel. And I worked at William Blair & Company, which is a terrific regional brokerage firm in Chicago and an investment bank. And while I was there, I learned all about all the other aspects of the business. My early role models have been stockbrokers, one in Princeton and one in Chicago. Stacy Adams was the first African-American stockbroker in Chicago's history on LaSalle Street, and he became my mentor and role model. But when I got to William Blair, I learned about, you know, private equity. I learned about investment banking, learned about venture capital. I learned about all these other things, but I fell in love with the mutual fund and money management division at William Blair. But I thought at age 24 they weren't going to hire me to manage money there for wealthy families and institutions. So that's how I got the idea to start Ariel. And then I have to say also, I was heavily influenced by those other entrepreneurs that I mentioned earlier, those Johnsons that I talked about. They were so visible in our community, and they had started businesses at a young age, and that was an inspiration that maybe I could do it too.
You met some of the Detroit area's finest students this afternoon, and you had a chance to be asked a number of questions. And here's one I think that's coming from them. Were you in leadership roles early on in your life? And what advice can you give our students today about taking on those roles at their age?
I was so sports oriented. I was you know, captain of the basketball team in high school, captain of the basketball team at Princeton. So I showed some leadership skills. Because I certainly didn't get to be captain at Princeton based upon my basketball skills. So it had to be leadership. Coach Carrill said I was legally blind and he couldn't teach vision, so I didn't see him. But when I got home from college, these lessons that Coach Carrill had taught about teamwork, I decided I wanted to be part of a number of teams in Chicago. So I was going to be a part of the Princeton team, and I volunteered there and became a leader in their schools committee, where it's relevant actually because the schools committee is the group that interviews prospective students. And so by volunteering to help Princeton, being a good teammate to Princeton, I met Melody Hobson when she was a 17 years old prospective Princeton student. She worked for us one summer, and now she's been with us 27 years, and now is my business partner and is our most valuable player. So Coach Carrill was right, by volunteering to help others, good things happened. I also tried to be part of the Chicagoland business community and volunteer and be a good teammate there. And you guys, I know here in Detroit, you guys have been doing a wonderful job of having your business community and your political community and a nonprofit community coming together to build a stronger Detroit. Well, I was a part of that in Chicago and got to be chairman of the Park District. And then I got involved as part of the African-American team and got involved with being, I've been on the Urban League board now for over 30 years. And I mean, it was 32 years, some crazy amount of time. And that led me to have a chance to get involved more politically, where I got to be the chairman of Carol Mosley Braun's finance committee, be a part of her team, got to be co-chair of the finance committee for President Obama when he ran, co-chair of the Illinois finance committee when he ran for president, working with Juliana in the back there. And she was the one doing all the heavy lifting. So I've been able to be a part of a lot of great, great teams. And that's been the idea, that if you get involved with things you care about, show up, think about your teammates first, then I found that you could sort of grow and learn and be successful within those teams.
Can you talk about, let's amplify teamwork and make it more personal as it relates to Ariel. How do you make sure that you're getting the best each and every day from your Ariel colleagues?
That is a very tough one. I think you hire a Melody Hobson, and the way that we work, and I focus on investing, picking stocks, doing research, talking to management teams. That's my day job. and she runs everything else, and she is extremely tough and direct and honest, and if people don't make it, she's going to make it clear to them when they're not making it, holding them accountable, and she does a terrific job of that and is, you know, helps make sure that we're attracting the best of the best of the best people, which has gotten easier as we've gone around all these years. But then if someone isn't making it, she's the one that's going to hold them accountable and move on to an improvement. So having great teammates around you, I think, helps you to do that. And then we talked earlier, I do try to create a culture at Ariel where everybody understands that their opinions matter. It's a very flat organization, and everybody's a shareholder. All 90 employees at the firm own stock in the company, and we think that that's another way of showing that they're truly a part of the team. And then finally, we look out for ways to help our teammates be successful in the community and helping them with their volunteer activities, supporting them financially and time-wise as they build their outside activities, which we think is part of what a modern progressive company should do.
Ariel has always been considered as a socially responsible investment company. In addition to diversity, what other values are important to Ariel investment managers, and what values, policies, or behaviors might disqualify a company from consideration?
A company itself? Well, I think maybe this is, I'll answer this a little bit narrowly. You know, we started out in the beginning not investing investing in companies that were involved with South Africa, again, following the Sullivan principles. We tried also, we've not invested in tobacco companies or handgun manufacturers. Those have been sort of cornerstones of what we do. Now we're looking and working under John Oxby here as one of our teammates to have a broader ESG initiative that's more public and where we talk about it more. Because what we've always done at Ariel is to talk to companies about how progressive they are around the environment. Are they susceptible to fines or litigation or problems? What are their relationships with their labor base? We're going to be looking at those things seriously. The quality of their board. And we've also pushed them all hard on the diversity of their boards. And if we find companies that don't have diverse boards, we'll tell them, we said, how can we own your stock if you look more like a 1940s company than a 2017 company? How are you going to achieve excellence if you aren't going out and getting diverse talent? And so we've worked really hard to push all of our companies on that, and then to recommend people to them for the board. And we've had, I would say, a couple of dozen successes over the years of companies that either listened to us directly and put diverse board members on for the first time that we recommended, or they found someone from their own community that they wanted on the board. But we've been able to make a difference around some of these socially responsible issues in ways that maybe a lot of people don't really know about at Ariel. And then finally, I should say, we wanted, as I said earlier, encourage everyone to be involved in the community. So Melody chairs After School Matters, which is a big after school program. Our vice chairman, Charlie Bobrinskoy, runs a program where he has primarily Catholic schools and some private schools working, and some public schools, with a similarly skinny down version of our financial literacy program that I talked about with the Ariel Community Academy.
Given the stock market today, what are your thoughts regarding passive investing versus an active style that you might employ at Ariel?
Well, this passive investment, I've seen over the years that, you know, we've had cycles like this before, where passive investing takes over and everyone thinks all of us active managers are really stupid and not worth our fees. And, you know, it's problematic when it happens. Money flows out, people hire passive. This has been the worst cycle I've ever seen in all of my years. And I think part of it is because we have this fiduciary rule that is this new regulatory environment is empowered some of the legal and the plaintiff's bar to challenge some corporations about whether they're paying too much in fees for their active managers. So it is a problem today. But I do think, and most of us who've been doing this for a long time, think that even though this is the worst cycle ever, it ultimately will shift and change. And when the market finally has its inevitable correction at some point, then you'll see the benefits of active management. And we think that a lot of these index funds have gotten to be very, very expensive. Some of the big companies in them, I talked about their great businesses, these Googles and Alphabet and Amazon, et cetera, are wonderful businesses, but they've gotten to be very, very expensive. And when inevitably the indexes fall, they're going to fall very rapidly. And again, active managers, I think, will really shine in that environment.
One final question. How are you a different leader today than when you first started out leading Ariel Investments?
Well, I think the as a leader, I think the number one thing, as I touched on this earlier, we're more diversified than ever. It used to be everything was based on the domestic equity products that I managed in Chicago, and that I did everything. And so over time, we realized the best way for you to be successful is you needed to have great teammates. And we have several of our great teammates here. One of our portfolio managers, Ken Curtis, here. We have Malik Murray, one of our top marketing teammates, is here. I'm not sure I'm missing anyone that I hadn't mentioned already. Tell me if I did. Oh, Shana is here from our research department. There, Shana. So we have a great group of people. So as a leader now, part of the job is coaching, training, hiring, retaining the best talent, and you're not there all the time. We have a great international and global team in New York run by a dynamic leader, Rupal Bhansali, and it's just been a really nice, I've always thought I loved coaching, so that's been something that's been a real benefit for me. And so I think as I've evolved, a lot of the job is not only picking stocks and doing research, but creating an environment where you can attract and retain the best people, and they can help you to do all these things that we do at Ariel, and which we think is important that you share the responsibilities. And the only other thing I would say is I understand more as a leader now the difference that we can all make in our communities, as I said, or if we fight together around these issues, and that you have to stay focused and stay diligent and keep staying on message around these ideas. So that's why I talked about some of them today, and some of you have heard me speak about these things around the country. But again, if we want to be able to make a difference, you've got to stay focused. So I think as a leader now, I'm trying to figure out how not only can we stay focused, but how do you bring others into the fold and join this cause around how do we solve this wealth gap and opportunity gap in this country? Because you can't do it yourself. So it's another way that I understand that as I'm growing as a leader, I can't just sit and bellyache about it, hopefully have some solutions, share those solutions with others, try to bring others into the fold again and try to make a difference.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Rogers and the John Rogers team, stand up. Those are here with the John Rogers. Thank you.
John Rogers, thank you so much for your leadership on this very important topic. Mayor Archer, always outstanding having you with us. And folks in the audience, have a great week. This meeting is adjourned.